How do you do? Mr. George Bartley feels it would be a little unkind to present this podcast without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold the story of Frankenstein. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It may even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such strain, now is the chance to... I've warned you. The first words of this episode are a shortened and somewhat altered version of the introduction to the 1931 movie adaptation of Frankenstein. It appeared that that Universal Studios felt that a warning was necessary at the beginning of the movie to basically cover themselves. They were just not sure how people would react to Frankenstein. Stay tuned for the complete version of this introduction, the making of the movie, and the audience's overall reaction. And welcome to Celebrate Poe, Episode 54, Gods and Monsters. Now, just to let you know, plans are to release this podcast every Monday night at 12 o'clock midnight. This episode zeroes in on what is arguably the most important literary contribution of the Romantic writers, Frankenstein. And most people would agree that the most well-known adaptation based on Mary Shelley's novel is the 1931 film version. This will probably be the longest episode of this podcast so far, so hopefully there's just so much that I want to get in, and I hope to be able to do it in less than an hour. First, I want to tell you about a health issue of mine that may seem way off topic, but I promise it will lead back to eventually the subject of Frankenstein. Back around the middle of December last year, and that seems like eons ago, I had what turned out to be a minor operation to remove some cancerous cells on my forehead caused by basically running outside in the sun too much. It took a while to heal, but the worst part was not being able to exercise like the way I was accustomed. I used to bench press 200 pounds. During the healing process, I couldn't lift over 5 pounds. I used to be a marathon runner and swimmer, but as a result of inactivity during the recovery, I gained almost 40 pounds. Well, this week, my doctor told me that my blood pressure had shot up and needed to be controlled. So I'm really back into exercising, using 2 medicines, and taking the steps that are necessary to bring blood pressure down. It's interesting that about half the population of the United States has high blood pressure, half of the adults, and 1/5 of that group does not know it. So I'm concentrating on maintaining a healthy lifestyle, lots of physical activity, and restricting sodium. And stress can also be a contributing factor. I came to the conclusion that 3 podcast episodes a week with all the research necessary was just too much. And the quality suffered. So, at least for now, I'm going to continue with the 1 episode a week released each Monday at midnight. I'm going to try to stay with that. That will give me the week to do research, and I intend to record each episode on Sunday afternoon. Of course, the episodes about Poe should be a lot easier. But with Frankenstein and Dracula movies, the research is a lot more enjoyable. The doctor said that the blood pressure medicine is not going to start working right away, so it looks like I'm going to have my share of horror films to watch. Now, when I was a kid, I used to go to the local theater with my sister downtown and watch special double features of Frankenstein. These had probably been released and re-released. This was not when they first came out in the 1930s. I'm not that old. So the theater obviously wanted to do something to boost the popularity of the movies that had been shown there many times before. The theater therefore hired a man to dress as Frankenstein on Saturdays, and the place was always packed that day. I will never forget sitting in a darkened theater when the door in the back opened and a man in a shabby Frankenstein outfit and boots entered the theater. He would begin howling and slowly lumbered down the aisle, occasionally holding out his arms as though he was going to grab someone. But when a kid screamed, and of course we always did, he shook all over as though he was scared and very confused. Then he would growl and continue acting as though he was going to terrorize some other kid. The audience loved it, and at this point we were screaming at the top of our lungs. We knew it was just a man in ragged clothes, but to us it was a real monster. We knew that nothing bad was going to happen to us, and we enjoyed being scared. It was something about that group of kids acting as one community in our shared fears. Many scholars believe that horror films are indirectly descended from the mind of Poe, and we'll certainly see that influence throughout this podcast. But for right now, watching old horror movies is just plain mindless fun. For example, in this episode, I spent hours doing research, reading about Frankenstein, and watching old movies. But it got to the point where I was torn between learning more about dealing with my high blood pressure. After all, it was my life. A big concern, at least to me, and enjoying old horror movies. But of course, I had a reason to watch old movies. It was to do this podcast. But I forced myself away from the subject of Frankenstein and started reading a book, High Blood Pressure for Dummies, a comparatively interesting and even funny treatment of a subject that is often just as dry as dust. Well, part of my mindset was to get totally away from anything dealing with Frankenstein. But on the title page of a section of the book, considering the medical consequences, was a cartoon by Rich Tennant set in a doctor's office. The doctor had a stethoscope around his neck and was speaking to a patient seated on a table. Sure enough, the patient was the creature from Frankenstein, complete with large, heavy boots, bolts in his neck, and a flat head. And the caption had the doctor saying, "It is important that you get your high blood pressure under control. It could not only affect your kidney and heart, but also your current brain." The story of Frankenstein, especially that of the movie version, has become such an important and recognized part of our culture. So important that the image of the creature can be used to communicate even medical concepts to the general public. My favorite cartoons along these lines include one of Edgar Allan Poe, who has also become a recognized part of our culture, holding a raven in a cage in a pet shop. He's speaking to a salesperson, and the caption reads, "I want to return this bird. He only says one word." And then, of course, this is my favorite. There's the passive-aggressive raven. He only says, "Never mind." But I digress. The first movie version of Frankenstein was a 15-minute silent short and is considered the first horror film. It was filmed by Thomas Edison Studios in 1910. Shot in 3 or 4 days in the Bronx, because see, New York City, not Hollywood, was then the center of the movie business, the film tried, in the words of an Edison spokesman, to, quote, "eliminate all actual repulsive situations and to concentrate its endeavors upon the mystic and psychological problems that are to be found in this weird tale." I have a link to that 15-minute movie in the show notes and transcript for this episode. And of course, being filmed in 1910, the original would have been in black and white and was restored by the Library of Congress National Audio Visual Conservation Center in 2017. And like most movies of that period, the acting is quite melodramatic, but it gives you a very good idea of how the first cinematic version of Frankenstein came across. And this is all on YouTube. This would have obviously been a silent movie in 1910, but it's interesting to experience the sound quality, the superior quality of the 1931 version of Frankenstein, just 21 years later. And it could be said that the 1931 version came to be partially because of Dracula. You see, at the time, Universal Pictures released a risky horror film starring a Hungarian-American actor named Bela Lugosi. The interesting part is Bela Lugosi was basically an unknown, and the student didn't really expect much. Hard to believe when you look at the movie today, it seems rather cheesy, but Dracula was a critical favorite and one of the biggest moneymakers of the year. After this podcast has had several episodes on Frankenstein, I plan to look at John Polidori's The Vampire and Bram Stoker's Dracula. And while the movie adaptation of Dracula did not become as popular overall as Frankenstein, I want to include the vampire-slash-undead legend because it played such an important part in several of Poe's stories. Now, back to Hollywood. Of course, with Hollywood, if they find that there's a certain genre or type of movie that can make a lot of money, you immediately have lots of follow-ups and or imitators. But this didn't really apply to horror in the early 1920s and even 30s, except for Dracula. Horror was a totally unproven genre. At the time, Variety reported, producers are not certain whether nightmare pictures have a box office pull or whether Dracula is just a freak. I think it's interesting that they called horror films nightmare pictures. That's why Universal Pictures was really worried about adapting Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Dracula had been based on a book that was only 34 years old at the time. On the other hand, Frankenstein had been published in 1818, had a comparatively complicated structure, and was filled with archaic language. I think it's interesting that when the idea of making Frankenstein into a movie arose, Carl Laemmle Sr., the founder of Universal Studios, was initially not eager to make Mary Shelley's novel into a movie. He had grave reservations. A little sidebar here. The founder of Universal's was Carl Laemmle. That name is spelled L-A-E-M-M-L-E. If you're like me when you first saw the word, or if you saw the word, you have no idea how to pronounce it. So I watched an interesting video on YouTube by a member of the Laemmle family. And she talked about how she's heard the name said all kinds of ways. When people would see the name in writing, they were frequently confused. But the correct way of spelling the word, or pronouncing the word, is Laemmle. I use a memory aid. You know me and my memory aids. Lem, L-E-M, like lemon, and Lee, L-E-E, like Annabelle Lee, Laemmle. Apparently, the Laemmle name is an important one in Hollywood history. So, unless you're from Southern California or a diehard movie nerd, yesterday you probably didn't know how to correctly pronounce Laemmle. So at least you can say that you've learned something today. But back to Frankenstein. Carl Laemmle was reported to have said about filming Frankenstein, "I know that most of the studios in town have turned the story down. I don't believe in horror pictures. It's morbid. None of our officers are for it. People don't want that sort of thing." But fortunately for us, his son, simply known as Junior, pushed for the movie with Bela Lugosi as the creature. Now, Mary Shelley's book was in the public domain, but when the decision was made to make Frankenstein into a movie in 1931, Laemmle Sr. tried to cover his legal basis by buying the film rights to a popular stage version of Frankenstein written by Peggy Webling in 1927. The play was called Frankenstein, An Adventure in the Macabre. Critics had called the play illiterate and inconceivably crude, but the public seemed to feel differently. There were several changes in the play version. For one, the play eliminates Mary Shelley's multiple narratives, where she tells the story from three different perspectives. This obviously would not have worked in a play, much less a movie. And the play liked to emphasize Dr. Frankenstein and the creature as almost two sides to the same person. Thus, the doctor was called Frankenstein, and the monster was also called Frankenstein. Many Frankenstein scholars, and yes, there is such a thing as a Frankenstein scholar, believe this is why many people use Frankenstein to refer to the doctor as well as the creature. Where in the novel, Mary Shelley refers to the creature as the creation and Dr. Frankenstein as Dr. Victor Frankenstein. So, have you got that? Okay. Now, Universal Studios hired James Whale to direct Frankenstein. Though he liked to put on English aristocratic airs, Whale's beginnings were actually very humble. He was the son of a blast furnace man in Dudley, England, and was constantly reminded by those around him that he was in the lower class, and he would always be. He first worked as a cobbler, but he made so little money that he had to sell the nails he burned out of old soles. Apparently, he did have a great deal of artistic talent, but working as an artist was out of the question for someone of his economic class. When World War I broke out, Whale enlisted in the army. In August 1917, he was taken prisoner on the Western Front in Belgium, which is really where his future career began. In a prisoner of war camp, he wrote, directed, and acted in amateur theater productions and realized that he had finally found his calling. James Whale first directed an unknown Laurence Olivier, later Sir Laurence Olivier, in 1928's Journey's End, a play about World War I. That production was wildly successful, and when Olivier left the role for another play, he was replaced by English actor Colin Clive. Now, stick a pin in that name. This episode will come back to Colin Clive as the actor who was to play Dr. Frankenstein in the 1931 movie. Journey's End later came to New York, was a huge success on Broadway for James Whale, and soon Hollywood came calling. Now, when Universal Studios chose James Whale as the director for Frankenstein, he thought the idea was a bit of a joke. Then, after a great deal of thought, he threw himself into the project, like the seasoned pro he was, and said, "I thought it would be amusing to try and make what everyone knows is a physical impossibility seem believable. Also, it offered fine pictorial chances, had two great characterizations, and a subject matter that might go anywhere. And that's part of the fun of making motion pictures." James Whale was definitely an erudite Englishman and brought a tremendous sense of style to the production of a horror film. He was certainly influenced by German expressionist films of the time. Now, German Expressionism was a movement that favored highly stylized, often dreamlike visuals over flat realism. Whale was certainly influenced by such films from the 1920s as The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Golem, and Metropolis. You can find snippets, excerpts, and even entire versions of the movies on YouTube of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Golem, and Metropolis. Movie scholar Rex Ingram writes that much of Frankenstein was also greatly influenced by The Magician, which he knows Whale saw. According to Ingram, but nobody had done it so artfully. I'm including a link to the colorized version of the In Hell section from The Magician, as well as the link to the entire film on YouTube in the show notes and transcript for this episode. The Magician is about an alchemist who, like Dr. Frankenstein, wants to create life. He finds that he needs the blood of a virgin to complete his experiments and sends out his dwarf assistant to find the right girl. As far as some of the visuals that might have influenced Frankenstein go, first, there are multiple shots of the medieval castle on a mountaintop while the lightning flashes in a storm. Second, there are interior scenes showing the alchemist bent over his test tubes while preparing new laboratory life. Third, the magician's dwarf assistant, which looks like it could have been an inspiration for the lab assistant character in Whale's film, ambles down a stairway to admit three people to the castle. very reminiscent of the three characters, Elizabeth, the professor, and Victor being admitted to a windmill. And finally, there's Alice Terry strapped to what looks like a hospital gurney. If you substitute Boris Karloff for Terry, this and the previous scenes comprise some of the core ingredients of Frankenstein. By the way, the character of Victor is not the Victor Frankenstein of Mary Shelley's novel. This Victor is Victor Moritz, a friend of Dr. Frankenstein and a fellow university student. The character of Dr. Frankenstein in Whale's adaptation is known as Henry Frankenstein. There are many sections of The Magician that could have served as a visual template for the many scenes of Frankenstein. Now, to establish believability in the film, Whale understood that casting was everything. He chose Colin Clive, who had performed in Journey's End, as Dr. Henry Frankenstein. Regarding Colin Clive, Whale said that he had exactly the right kind of tenacity to go through with anything. Colin Clive was an excellent actor and had played a well-received Hamlet at the Haymarket Theatre in London. And after several years in Hollywood, he was an in-demand leading man for many of the major film actresses of the time, such as Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis. Mae Clark, his co-star in Frankenstein, said he was the most handsome man she ever knew, and he was also the saddest. Clive had an intensity, but also suffered from a severe chronic alcoholism problem. His alcoholism became obvious to his co-stars because they often saw him napping on the movie set. Clive sometimes was so intoxicated that he had to be held upright for the over-the-shoulder shots. He was also tormented by the medical threat of amputating his long-damaged leg. Colin Clive died from complications of tuberculosis and alcoholism in 1937, when he was just 37. Whale first considered Betty Davis for the role of Elizabeth, Dr. Frankenstein's fiancée, but she was rejected for her supposed lack of sex appeal. Imagine turning down Betty Davis. Instead, Whale chose Mae Clark. Now, Mae Clark was then best known for being smacked with a grapefruit by James Cagney in 1931's Public Enemy. I still can't believe that they turned down Betty Davis. But I guess Mae Clark was more popular at the time. But there was another actor that really impressed Universal executive David Lewis. And that actor was Boris Karloff, who Lewis had seen perform as a convict in the play The Criminal Code. David Lewis was an influential executive at the studio who also happened to have been romantically involved with James Whale and lived with him for several years. This was a comparatively controversial thing to do, especially in the 1920s. In the movie Gods and Monsters, the character of James Whale, as played by Ian McKellen, says that the studios did not really care about your private life that much as long as you made money for them and were not blatant. That pretty much summed up Hollywood's attitude during that period. Now, Boris Karloff was born in the London suburb of Camberwell in 1887 as William Henry Pratt. He changed his name to Boris Karloff while acting on the stage in Canada. Karloff was forced to take on manual labor to make ends meet. Eventually, Karloff took a risk and moved to Los Angeles during the early days of motion pictures. By 1931, he had performed in dozens of films, but finally came to the conclusion that he was destined to be a starving actor, barely surviving on orange juice and raw eggs. As I mentioned before, David Lewis had seen Karloff and eventually suggested that he would be perfect for the role of the creature. Lewis said that Karloff was powerful and you needed to have a powerful monster. So Whale contacted the 43-year-old Karloff and planned to meet him for lunch. According to Karloff, he was in the Universal Commissary. Someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Mr. Whale would like to see you at his table." They were both quite cultured men and talked about the problems of being an English actor or director in the United States. When Whale told Karloff that he wanted him to do a screen test for the Frankenstein monster, the actor was taken somewhat aback. I was wearing a new set of clothes which I'd bought especially for the interview, and I thought I was looking rather smart. Monster indeed. Well, Karloff got the part, but Whale's challenges were far from over. For one thing, he strongly felt that the movie should be even scarier. "I thought it might just as well be as horrible as possible," he said. For one thing, the film's creature is unable to speak, unlike Mary Shelley's creature, who becomes quite articulate. And in obtaining a brain from a university classroom, Fritz, the assistant, drops the container with the normal brain in it, the glass shattering and preservative liquid flowing all over the floor. So he grabs the abnormal brain. The creature, therefore, is deranged because that abnormal brain is used. In the book, the monster's homicidal impulses are driven by society's rejection. Even so, James Whale wanted his monster to have a human side. This is one reason why Lugosi had lost the earlier role when he tried out for Frankenstein. Not surprisingly, the actor claimed that he did not want the part because it didn't have any dialogue. Whale later said, Lugosi was basically scary. No one would feel sorry for him. Now, some actors today would bemoan the fact that they've become famous because of a specific role and are afraid of being typecast. Karloff, on the other hand, was extremely grateful for the role of Frankenstein and turned what some actors might consider a one-note role into a career. I guess he was also glad that he had a part that made him not only wealthy, but a cultural figure that everyone recognized, especially after all those years of living the part of a starving artist. Karloff's role was physically demanding in the extreme. He would actually have to recline on a board between scenes, most likely to take the heavy costume's weight off his bad back. And after filming the film's climax, in which he carries Dr. Frankenstein uphill to a windmill, the actor had to be hospitalized. His makeup for the Frankenstein monster weighed about 35 pounds. During the filming of the movie, he would have to show up at Universal's makeup department before 4 o'clock in the morning because the makeup took almost 4 hours to apply. At one point, Karloff said that his eyes looked too alive, so they applied mortician's wax to his eyelids, which gave him kind of a dull look. And that was just what they wanted. Apparently, though, this mortician's wax was quite painful. The complicated makeup was designed by Jack Pierce, that's P-I-E-R-C-E, Pierce, the head of Universal's makeup department. Pierce had designed Bela Lugosi's look for Dracula and went on to create the looks for the 1932 The Mummy and the 1941 The Wolfman. I thought he looked the best. He was my personal favorite. But none of Pierce's future work would equal the effect of his makeup for the Frankenstein monster. Now, a note about the creature's look. James Whale felt that the monster's appearance was essential to the public's acceptance of the creature. As for the creature's look, well, in Mary Shelley's novel, she had written, and you might recognize some of this text from episode 54, True to the Original. Some of you may have even memorized it. "His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries. Beneath his hair was a lustrous black and flowing. His teeth of a pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun-white sockets in which they were set." Now imagine what that might have looked like on screen. I'm going to read that again and ask you to figure out how you would go about getting similar effects. His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath his hair was of a lustrous black and flowing. His teeth of a pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set. Besides sounding a bit cumbersome, Mary Shelley did certainly do a good job describing his face without saying too much, but I don't think she was writing for the screen. In other words, she just didn't leave a lot to go on. So, like many movies, months of preparation had to go into planning for the movie before the cameras started rolling. In the case of the creature's appearance, James Whale and Jack Pierce basically had to start from scratch, especially with a description like that. It was important to Whale to make the monster both frightening as well as pitiful. For inspiration, Pierce said he spent 3 months studying anatomy, surgery, medicine, criminal history, criminology, ancient and modern burial customs, and electrodynamics. In the process, he learned that a surgeon can remove a brain from a skull in 6 ways. He said, "I figured that Frankenstein, who was a scientist but no practicing surgeon, would take the simplest surgical way. He would cut through the top of the skull off straight off across like a pot lid, hinge it, pop the brain in, and then clamp it on tight. That's the reason that I decided to make the monster's head square and flat like a shoebox and dig that big scar across his forehead with the metal clamps holding it together." Pierce also put bolts to represent electrodes on the actor's neck. You know, one side negative and the other side positive. He also coated Karloff's skin with cheesecloth, putty, and bluish-green makeup. In black and white, the skin came across as a deathly gray. Karloff actually continued to the creature's look himself. "We said that we found the eyes were too bright and seemed too understanding, where dumb bewilderment was so essential. So I waxed my eyes to make them heavy, half-seeing." James Whale was concerned that the actor's frame might be too slight. So Whale gave him a heavy coat and a great deal of padding. I've read that his boots weighed 13 pounds each, certainly enough to prevent comfortable walking and help create the monster's lumbering movements. As a result, Karloff's chronic back pain worsened. For James Whale, the famous creation scene where Frankenstein exclaims, "It's alive! It's alive!" was a pivotal point in the movie. But once again, there was no inspiration to go on. Webling's play had avoided the scene entirely, and Mary Shelley wrote, "With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me, that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already one in the morning. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out, when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs." I think it's interesting that this description, according to Leslie S. Klinger, editor of the New Annotated Frankenstein, matches exactly the experience of Professor Giovanni Aldini, who attempted to revive a hanged man by applying electricity. This podcast will later delve into Edgar Allan Poe's interest in similar pseudosciences of his day, especially galvanism. But this description in Mary Shelley's novel doesn't really explain the nuts and bolts, no pun intended, of how the monster was created. I guess Mary Shelley realized it was more powerful to leave the details to the reader's imagination. Frankenstein was a movie that really did a lot of things that no movie had ever shown or done before, such as a body hanging down from a tree and being cut down, or the loud thumping of ground being shoveled onto the top of a coffin. Audiences had never seen cadavers on screen. They were especially shocked by the close-up of the creature being stuck with a hypodermic needle. Such sights would be G-rated on TV today, but had never been seen before when Frankenstein was released. The most notorious episode shows the creature murdering a little girl, Marilyn Harris, while picking flowers. Frankenstein sees a little girl, and she's one of the only people who's not afraid of him, and she does not really understand what he is doing. He doesn't understand really what he's doing. His appearance does not scare her, and she accepts him unconditionally. Frankenstein and the little girl start picking daisies and throwing the flowers into the water to watch them float. Frankenstein eventually runs out of flowers and picks up the little girl to throw her into the water and watch her float. He innocently throws her in the water and she drowns. That scene was frequently censored along with other cuts. For example, censors in Kansas City, Missouri demanded 32 cuts, almost half the movie, and some scenes that had appeared in the original version were cut from its 1937 re-release, resulting in multiple versions of the movie. It wasn't until 1985 that a wholly restored version of the original was released. Even so, censored versions are still sometimes shown on TV. To be completely fair, if I had seen such a version on TV when I was, say, a six-year-old, if I had seen a child killed on screen, years ago I would have been very upset and probably couldn't have handled it at that age. The movie had a 30-day schedule and a budget of $262,000. Whale began filming on August the 24th, 1931. The shoot was easy enough for Karloff until the 10th day, when he was first put into full monster makeup and costume. He said, "I spent 3.5 hours in the makeup chair getting ready for that day's work. The makeup itself was very painful, particularly the putty on my eyes. There were days when I thought I would never be able to hold out until the end of the day." Karloff had to arrive at the studio at 4 o'clock a.m., fueled by lots of cigarettes and tea, not coffee, after all, he was English. Karloff was on the set after several hours of going through makeup. And of course, he had to be in costume and padded by 9 o'clock and usually worked until 6 in the evening. Then it took at least 2 hours to pry the makeup off, using acetone, an extremely flammable solvent. In its entirety, this was at least a 16-hour day, and the only things he had time for when he got home was a rub down and a light dinner before going to bed. By the way, a rub down was necessary because of all the wear and tear on his feet and legs from the boots. Near the end of the movie, after Frankenstein attacks Elizabeth when she is temporarily alone on her wedding night, the film shows her on a bed, face up, with her head and her hands hanging down. A very weird position. When I saw the film, I was struck by the similarity of Elizabeth's position to a painting by John Henry Fuseli's. And I've heard John Henry Fuseli and John Henry Fuseli, but I'll go with John Henry Fuseli. Anyway, the painting by John Henry Fuseli is called The Nightmare. Oh, it is something. It was painted in 1781 and shows a sleeping woman lying on her back on a bed with her arms thrown below her, very similar to the position of Elizabeth after the creature had attacked her. Now, in the painting, a demonic and ape-like incubus is crouched on the woman's chest. By the way, according to mythology, an incubus was a demon in male form who would lie upon a sleeping woman in order to have sex with them. The female form of that demon is called a succubus, very popular, from what I hear, in the paranormal romance genre. The belief was that repeated sexual activity with either an incubus or a succubus could result in the deterioration of health, mental illness, or even death. not exactly the kind of creatures you want to have around at night. You know, I've found that there seems to be a tradition of incubus or succubus creatures all over the world throughout history, such as the gods who come at night to chew off children's toes in South Africa. Ooh, that would make a cool off-topic episode, and I think I'll do one in the future about that, but I digress. I did some research to see if the painting had any possible connection to Frankenstein and found that the painting The Nightmare most likely influenced Mary Shelley in that scene from her novel. Now, follow me on this one. Mary Shelley would have been familiar with the painting. Her parents, Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin, knew Henry Fuseli. It is not too big a stretch to imagine that Mary Shelley drew on the imagery of that canvas, whether consciously or subconsciously. Mary Shelley wrote in describing Elizabeth's death, "She was there, lifeless and inanimate, thrown across the bed, her head hanging down, and her pale and distorted features half covered by hair." In the new annotated Frankenstein by Dr. Sylvia Leslie, the author also says that the painting of The Nightmare is believed to be an inspiration for that portion of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The author points out that Fuseli was Swiss, but actually lived most of his life in England. He was a fixture in the circle of radical artists and thinkers that included Mary Shelley's parents, William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin. There is even evidence, and this surprised me, of a romantic relationship between Fuseli and Mary Wollstonecraft. Now, Mary Shelley would have certainly known about this amorous relationship, and she certainly knew Fuseli's work. I thought that was rather interesting and wondered whether to include this connection. Thought that it might be kind of a minor for a podcast dealing with Poe, and then I accidentally ran across the fact that Edgar Allan Poe may have evoked Fuseli's nightmare in his short story, The Fall of the House of Usher of 1839. You can easily imagine that my heart started beating faster when I saw that the narrator in a Poe story compared a painting hanging in Roderick Usher's house to a Fuseli work. Poe has the narrator state, and bear with me on this one, that an irrepressible tremor gradually pervaded my frame, and at length there sat upon my heart an incubus of utterly causeless alarm. Well, my first reaction was, that's an ominous choice of words. There sat upon my heart an incubus of utterly causeless alarm. Apparently, incubus was also an archaic word for night terrors, and Poe sure did like his archaic words, giving them a sense of timelessness and dread that you couldn't quite put your finger on. And to further deepen the meaning of incubus, the word incubus, in addition to having an archaic sense all its own, has an even more archaic meaning, incubus as apprehension or dread. Now, Poe and Fuseli both shared an interest in the subconscious. Fuseli is often quoted as saying, "One of the most unexplored regions of art is dreams." It is said that as a painter, Fuseli favored the supernatural, as well as characters and situations with a dreamlike quality. And in A Dream Within a Dream from 1849, Edgar Allan Poe wrote, "Take this kiss upon the brow, and in parting from you now, thus much let me avow. You are not wrong who deem that my days have been a dream. Yet if hope has flown away in a night or in a day, in a vision or in none, is it therefore the less gone? All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream."
It's alive!
Universal Studios finally finished filming Frankenstein. How's that for a tongue twister? Finally finished filming Frankenstein on October the 3rd, 5 days past schedule and $30,000 over budget. It was too late to back out now, but Universal executives were extremely nervous. Had Dracula been a fluke? Would audiences find Frankenstein too scary and avoid it altogether? Even worse, would they find it funny, a silly little film of no import? To minimize bad publicity, the first screening was held in Santa Barbara, away from the prying eyes of the press. Universal was so concerned that they began the movie with a character coming out from behind a curtain and introducing the film with a warning. They were afraid that the movie just might be too much for audiences of the Great Depression. The movie began with, "How do you do? Mr. Carl Laemmle feels that it would be a little unkind to present this picture without just a word of friendly warning. We're about to unfold the story of Frankenstein, a man of science who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning upon God. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think that it will thrill you. It may shock you. It may even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such strain, now is your chance to, well, we've warned you." In the opening credits, Karloff was billed only as question mark. He later said that he wasn't even invited to the premiere since he was considered an unimportant freelance actor. During the first scene, which showed a graveyard funeral procession, David Lewis said, "You could hear the whole audience gasp. As the film progressed, the audience became increasingly unsettled. People got up, walked out, came back in, and walked out again," he continued. "It was an alarming thing. When the film ended, there was no applause, just stunned silence." Now, Universal was really worried. They considered cutting even more of what might be considered disturbing scenes until Eddie Montag, a studio director, reassured everyone. His insight was the recognition that the audience's reaction showed that they were totally immersed in the movie and moved by its effects. He summed up the situation very concisely with, "You've got the hit of all time." Surprisingly, even the federal censor didn't demand cuts, though a few states made their own. Some of Frankenstein's more troubling elements, including the scene in which the creature drowns a young girl, were cut, as well as dialogue that was considered blasphemous, such as Victor Frankenstein exclaiming, "Now I know what it's like to be God." Of course, there's no substitute for watching the original 1931 Frankenstein in its entirety, and I highly recommend that. You can take in the flow of the story, the innovative camera work, and the character development. James Whale did an incredible job in putting the elements together, both from an audience and artistic standpoint. For example, this is just a small example. In one scene, instead of showing the standard long shot, James Whale quickly switches from a close-up of one character, then three more fast close-ups of characters to establish tension. Then we see a long shot of the characters together. Your first instinct is to try and figure out what you're seeing in the seemingly unrelated close-ups and how they go together. That involves the audience more because you have to figure out what the close-ups mean, or might mean. And that's just, again, a small example showing that a great deal of thought went into the making of the movie. Now, if you can't get the movie from your library, YouTube has some fantastic clips. And I put a link on the show notes and transcript for this episode that will give you a taste of the best of the 1931 Frankenstein. It is said that James Whale even had a formula for Frankenstein. Audiences were supposed to receive a chill every 45 seconds. The film featured 95 chills, which at 1931 admission prices worked out to approximately 3 chills to a penny. No wonder Frankenstein became such a successful movie. Frankenstein was exactly the right film for the times. It broke box office records all over the United States. Ambulances were parked next to theaters and nurses were stationed in theater lobbies where Frankenstein was playing. A gimmick that really worked. Psychologists say that people like tragic deaths when their own spirits are depressed. And remember, this was the time of the Great Depression, a time when the economy was even more depressed than that of last year. I'd like to end with a section from Frankenstein, annotated for scientists, engineers, and creators of all kinds. This was written in reference to Mary Shelley's novel, but also applies to James Whale's adaptation. The science fiction stories that we remember, such as Frankenstein, are ones that resonate with the public imagination. Most science fiction is forgotten shortly after it's published, but a few of those tales live on for years, decades, even centuries in the case of Frankenstein. The fact that a story captures the public imagination doesn't mean that it will come true in the future, but it tells you something about the present. You learn something about the world when a vision of the future becomes a subject of controversy or delight. If some poor English teacher has demanded that you identify the themes of Frankenstein, the obvious correct answer is that she is referring to ambition and hubris. Ambition, because Victor Frankenstein has challenged death itself, one of the universe's eternal verities. Everything dies, whales and humans and dogs and cats and stars and galaxies. Hubris, extreme pride or self-confidence, thanks Wikipedia, because as Victor brings his creature to life, he is so blinded by his own ambition that he fails to consider the moral consequences of his actions. He fails to ask himself how the thinking, living being he is creating will feel about, stitched together, imbued with life force, and ushered into the uncaring universe. Sources for this episode include Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, Monstrous Progeny, A History of the Frankenstein Narratives, It's the Pictures from Film School Rejects by Max Koval, Frankenstein Annotated for Scientists, Engineers, and Creators of All Kinds, edited by David H. Guston, Ed Finn, and Jason Scott Robert, The New Annotated Frankenstein by Dr. Sylvia Leslie, and the Life Special of 2018, Frankenstein, The Man, The Monster, The Legacy. Oh, and don't let me forget the documentary, The Frankenstein Files. Why not visit my podcast website at CelebratePoe.buzzsprout.com. And click on the episode that you want to learn more about to see its show notes and a transcript. I know on Apple Podcast, the show notes show up directly below the cover art for an episode, and you can go directly to a YouTube link. Join me for the next episode of Celebrate Poe, the best horror film ever. I had originally intended to deal with the book Frankenstein's Father and the movie version Gods and Monsters in this episode, but ended up having to save that for next week. And the next episode will also cover a movie sequel that is generally agreed to be even better than the original. Join me for the next episode, The Best Horror Film Ever.